You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 20th of August 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from London. I am Markus Hippi. On today's show, as US journalist James Foley is reportedly executed by ISIS, we'll assess the latest grim chapter in the chaos that is Syria and Iraq.
The big organizations like the BBC or The Guardian will move heaven and earth and pay a ransom and will never be talked about. You have something behind you, but if you're a freelancer, what do you do? I mean, who's going to bring in the cavalry for you?
My guests Samira Shackle and John Everard will discuss that and the day's other big stories. Then we check in with our correspondent in Istanbul and share with you the first part of our summer reading list.
It's an amazing story based on his own exploits. And he spent 10 years in India, where he started a new life in the slums of Bombay and then got involved in the murky underworld of the mafia.
We will also review the best comedy this year's Edinburgh Fringe has to offer. That is Midori House with me, Markus Hippi, right now. So lots coming up in the next hour here on Midori House, but before all that, here is Suzanne Chislett with the latest news.
Intelligence agencies in the United States have confirmed a video which shows the execution of an American journalist by Islamic State militants is genuine. James Foley was reporting in Syria when he disappeared 2 years ago. The man who kills him says his death is revenge for US airstrikes on members of the extremist group fighting Iraqi government forces. British authorities are trying to identify the killer, who appears to speak with a UK accent. The British Foreign Secretary is Philip Hammond.
We do everything we can in this country to try to divert people away from being attracted by recruiters to this evil ideology. But in the end, people are responsible for their own actions. And if young men, and for that matter women, join organisations like this, go out to places like Syria and Iraq and commit these appalling atrocities, they are culpable. We shouldn't start looking for any ways to apologise for them.
The UN has confirmed a 10-day aid operation is now underway to take humanitarian supplies to northern Iraq. Hundreds of thousands of people have left their homes there because of the IS advance. Rocket attacks and airstrikes are continuing in Gaza and southern Israel after the breakdown of the latest ceasefire. Israel accused Hamas of firing first, a claim the Palestinian militant group denies. Earlier, funerals took place for the wife and young son of the leader of Hamas. It says they died in an assassination attempt on Mohammed Diouf. At least 36 people have died after landslides in Japan. More than a month's rain fell in one night in Hiroshima. Authorities expect the death toll to rise as they search for people who've been reported missing. The US Attorney General Eric Holder is visiting the St. Louis suburb of Ferguson today, hours after dozens of people were arrested in an 11th night of violence. Protests about the killing of an unarmed black teenager by a white police officer are showing no sign of ending. Mr. Holder says he wants to be briefed on a civil rights investigation he's ordered into the death. The St. Louis County Prosecutor's Office is also expected to begin presenting evidence to a grand jury investigating the August the 9th shooting. The police chief Ron Johnson says 47 arrests were made last night, but the situation on the ground is improving.
One of the arrestees was an out-of-state violator. We've arrested for the third time. I also think that over the past 10 days, the men and women of law enforcement and the people of Ferguson have gotten to know better and understand one and to understand one another. It makes me proud every night as I see more and more police officers and residents interacting and smiling.
More than 1,200 people have now died in the Ebola outbreak centered on West Africa. Security forces have been deployed in the Liberian capital Monrovia to try to enforce a quarantine area. The newly appointed UN senior official for Ebola, Dr. David Nabarro, has warned the deadly disease is having massive impacts on societies.
It's affecting the social setting, it's affecting economies, it's affecting governance. It's got humanitarian consequences. It's got political repercussions. It may have security impacts. And so a really comprehensive support operation is necessary that involves all the different assets, tools, capacities in our United Nations system.
Thousands of Pakistani protesters have tried to blockade the country's parliament after an anti-government cleric told them not to allow anyone in or out of the building. They're angry at recent elections and allege fraud against the Prime Minister, Nawaz Sharif. He's thought to have been in the building at the time of the demonstration, but managed to escape through a back exit. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Suzanne Gislett will be back with more news headlines in 24 minutes. Meanwhile, you are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, see on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You are listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 18.06 and it is 13.06 in New York. Joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio are London-based journalist Samira Shackle and former British ambassador John Everard. Welcome to the programme, both of you. The Islamic State militant group released a video late last night showing the execution of the journalist James Foley, who was kidnapped in Syria in 2012. In this video, the masked militant speaks in British accent, which adds yet another layer of questions to this appalling story. Samira, if I start with you, you have been working as a journalist in quite hairy places. What are your thoughts regarding this story and what has happened?
It's an absolute tragedy, I think, for anyone just in general, but also I think generally sort of in the media. It's a very striking reminder of the kinds of risks people take. I think particularly war reporters, it's something that I haven't done and don't think I could do, just the extraordinary risks that you have to take. And James Foley had been detained before in Libya for 6 weeks before being taken hostage in Syria in 2012. So I think it's a very sobering reminder of those kinds of risks. It's also worth remembering that he was the 70th journalist to be killed in Syria, and the majority of those were local journalists from Syria or from other parts of the region. So it doesn't get the same kind of international press. But I think those sorts of incredibly brave reporters like James Foley are the first to point out that local journalists take equal, if not greater, risks.
It's also worth remembering that James Foley was working there as a freelancer, which might mean that he maybe had less of safety network.
That's true. I mean, I, as you said, I've been a freelance journalist in sort of risky countries, perhaps not as risky as Syria, but I think that's certainly true. You do have, a layer of less protection. I mean, I don't know about his insurance sort of status, but those things all become an issue. Those sort of technical things, not having a big organisation behind you to sort of push for your release. But on the other hand, I mean, while having a big organisation and the insurance that goes with it and the sort of security procedures that goes with it do give you a certain level of protection, I think once you're out there and you're in somewhere which has such little rule of law, there's probably a limit to what that protection can do in the moment.
John Everard, basing on your experience as a diplomat, what is your impression? How much was done during the past 2 years to actually get James out of Syria?
I really don't know. I'm sure that there were all kinds of talks. There usually are in these situations, but none of the detail is in the public domain, and I don't have the inside access I'd need to give a proper answer. But can I come back to one of the points you made right at the beginning, that the executioner speaking with a British accent. Yes, absolutely. I think those of us who live in this capital with a queasy feeling in the stomach can go further. He was talking with a thick South London accent, and I have a sick feeling that this man was brought up probably within about 15 kilometres of these studios.
And when you now mention that British accent, How worried should the UK be about this thing, realizing that there is someone who's actually at least been spending a significant amount of time in the UK?
I think that the Prime Minister is absolutely right to talk about the real threat now from the Islamic State in the UK. British citizens are being radicalized and being taught the black arts of military skills by the Islamic State, there will come a point when numbers of them, one way or another, start to return, which is a clear threat to everybody in this country.
Samira, if I continue with you then. Actually, John, I'm going to ask you one more question, if you may discuss this. Do you think, knowing that we had 2 years when James Foley was stuck in Syria and he was kidnapped, do you think the US would have considered playing ransom?
No, absolutely not. I think the United States has made clear its position on this in public repeatedly. America does not pay ransoms. Simple as that.
Do you think it would be a way of trying to avoid the situation of actually paying? Do you think they could do it once, but they wouldn't let the public know?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I can't be absolutely sure, of course. It's possible to arrange these things in secret. But knowing some of the people who get involved in difficult cases like this, I think that there are personal principles involved, not just broad politics. These people simply would not do that.
Samira, if I ask one more question from you, when we are looking at these countries, both the US and the UK, Australia has been saying something about this as well, about the worry of young men mostly going to these places to work, to go and fight, essentially. What do you think? Do you have an idea of what should be done to prevent this? How much can these governments do?
It's interesting, I think, this particular case, because it shows, probably for the first time, a very direct threat to the West. It's a sort of saying, if you're attacking us, we're going to come and get you. Whereas previously, despite the large numbers of foreign fighters from Europe and from elsewhere in the world going to fight in Syria, it remained very much a focus from ISIS, from affiliated groups on the region, on the Middle East, on Iraq, on Syria. And so it's quite a shift. And I think that sort of gives credence to the concerns. I think it's quite interesting. I mean, it's a subject I've done quite a bit of work on, and just speaking to various experts studying the flow of foreign fighters, they do warn against being overly punitive in terms of William Hague, when he was Foreign Secretary, spoke about prosecuting everybody for terrorism when they returned from Syria, regardless of what they've gone there for. And I think that becomes quite sort of shaky ground if you don't have any evidence of affiliation to radical groups or any evidence of criminal wrongdoing abroad. So it's a sort of, it's about finding the balance, really, where you're securing national security, you're taking steps to de-radicalise, perhaps even thinking about things like surveillance, but not sort of coming down too hard on every single person who might not have done anything wrong.
Yeah, Samira, coming to that, I agree strongly with what you said. I'd go a little bit further. I mean, I think it's becoming clear from, if you read sort of blogs going around the Muslim community, that there are quite a lot of people coming back from Syria who have been horrified by what they have seen, and are spreading the word that this isn't just a Muslim campaign. It's absolutely brutal.
John and Samira, let's stay in Syria for a bit longer. This week has seen President Bashar al-Assad significantly stepping up the government offensive against ISIS strongholds. Allowing the Islamist group to flourish in Syria seems to be a strategy that is backfiring now. Islamic State attacks on government-held areas in northern and eastern Syria seem to have forced Assad to change his strategy. Are we now seeing a situation where it seems that al-Assad, basically one of the worst enemies of the West, could be actually turning into some sort of an ally?
No, I don't think we are anywhere near that situation. I think it's clear that, as the State Department said yesterday, that Assad and the West have some common targets. But to move from there to talk about any kind of alliance, I think, is putting it far too strongly. There are also questions over just how hard Assad is hitting the Islamic State. I see that the Free Syrian Army has put out a statement saying that these are just pinpricks, token airstrikes he's launched, and that this is just for political consumption in the West. He's not actually serious yet about doing anything about the military threat.
Could you still imagine seeing some sort of communication between Bashar al-Assad and the West when it comes to fighting against the ISIS?
I think, as John says, it's a sort of complicated picture, I think, and it's part of the nature of the Syrian conflict that there isn't the sort of the government and the rebels is as simple as that, basically. There's the government, there's the moderate rebels who the West backs, and there's the extreme rebels who the West oppose and who now Assad opposes. I think the question of cooperation between Assad and the West is... It was quite a vexed one. I think there's certainly an element generally in sort of counter-terror operations overseas and at home that there tends to be a tendency towards realpolitik, you know, sort of pragmatism trumping all else. But on the other hand, I think Assad is still seen as the ruler who allowed ISIS to gain such a stronghold and who in fact empowered them because they were doing such a good job of sort of splitting the threat and fighting against the moderate rebels. So I don't think that there's going to be much trust for the Assad regime from Western governments.
Moreover, I think you have to bear in mind the presentation of this. Any Western government that was found to be in contact with Assad, any kind of coordinated policy, if anything like that came out, would be harpooned. I mean, the political downside is very, very steep.
For a long time, al-Assad turned a blind eye to the Islamic State's movements within Syria, and this is changing now. Do you think he would somehow try to signal that on some level he is actually on the same side with the West?
Yes, I think we're seeing signals to that effect coming out of Syria. He's trying, you know, he's pitching for greater international respectability. This is one of the reasons why he's doing what he's doing. But as I said, I frankly don't fancy his chance of success.
And what does this new battle between al-Assad and ISIS actually mean for the dynamics of the war we are seeing?
I think it's just a continuation of the incredibly complicated dynamics of war we've already seen, which is that it's, you know, for the sort of moderate rebels, the ones who are backed by the West, the original sort of Free Syrian Army, that they will continue to be, as they have been for many months now, fighting on two fronts, fighting against ISIS on the one hand, fighting against government forces on the other. So I think they're the main kind of loser in this. It's difficult to, I think when a conflict has been so intractable and so protracted, it's difficult to see anything really tipping the balance decisively one way or another. It's certainly true that Assad's regime is now sufficiently concerned about ISIS to start fighting back against it rather than sort of allowing it to do what it's doing. So I think it's just a sort of another chapter in a bloody and complicated conflict.
Do you think this would be some sort of an opportunity for the West to actually get some kind of progress? Could they actually benefit from this movement?
Well, yes, in the sense that anything that weakens the Islamic State will help the West effort to keep it under control. And I think we have to remember that although the Islamic State captured very large amounts of military equipment, largely from the Iraqi army, its ability to replenish that equipment is limited. So that if Assad does actually knock out a number of vehicles or destroy various other kinds of equipment, this does weaken the Islamic State, which of course takes some of the pressure off the Kurds and the Iraqi government at on the other front.
Let's continue with a short break now. You are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Marco Sipi, Samira Shackle and John Everard. And when we return, we'll discuss the ongoing protests in Pakistan as well as the latest developments in Gaza.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight from New York to Nairobi, Bamako to Berlin.
From Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
From Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
From Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delorne. From Monocle.
From Monocle.
In Tel Aviv.
From Monocle.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dane.
From Monocle, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
In Bogota.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
So, whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the must-sees at the latest film festival, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is Samira Shackle and John Everard. An estimated 50,000 protesters led by ex-cricketer-turned-politician Imran Khan and populist cleric Tahirul Qadri marched on Pakistan's parliament yesterday in a bid to depose the Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, who they accused of widespread vote rigging in the 2013 elections. Yesterday, protests reached the Red Zone, where Parliament, the Prime Minister's office and most foreign embassies are located. Samira, have these protests now taken on a new dynamic?
Well, I think that was the aim. As sort of context, the government had permitted the protests to go ahead, but had said that they couldn't go into the red zone. So when earlier this week Imran Khan and Tahirul Qadri separately said to their protesters they were going to storm the red zone, it seemed like a real sort of threat, an attempt to ramp up the situation. There was the sort of assumption that if protesters were to enter the red zone, it would be met with force by the huge numbers of army and security forces that are there. It seems that that hasn't happened. And just sort of speaking to people on the ground, apparently, the police and soldiers who are there have said they've been explicitly told not to meet the protesters with force. So it's remained quite peaceful. I think that there's some determination on the part of the army and the government to not give the protesters the sort of PR coup that they could have been seeking. So I think in that respect, it hasn't been quite the level of escalation that some were predicting.
How dangerous do you think this situation is for Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif?
It's difficult. I mean, it's not convenient for him, obviously. I don't think that he's going to be toppled by the protests. I mean, Imran Khan alone said that he pledged to get a million people out in the streets. I think it's rarely topped 20,000 in actual fact. And I actually don't think that there's a huge amount of appetite amongst the public for the government to be toppled, even amongst those who don't particularly support Nawaz Sharif specifically. I was in Pakistan for the general election last year, and there was a huge sense of celebration that it was the first moment that power had peacefully passed from one elected government to another. I don't think that people really want to see a return to the coups and so on that have sort of dominated Pakistan's history. And of course, I think if there is a threat to Nawaz Sharif, it will be from the army. I mean, if the army were to step in, that's when it would sort of get risky, I think.
John, I saw you nodding over there already. Do you agree with everything?
Yes, I do. And I'd add that firstly, is absolutely right that the people wouldn't want to see this fine democratic progress jeopardised by the military. But equally, I don't detect much appetite at the moment amongst the military for stepping in. The only military statement that I've seen so far is a fairly bland call for dialogue and peace resolution of these protests. There are no indications yet that the men in uniform are preparing to leap in.
Do you think these protests could jeopardise Pakistan's regional ties with its neighbours, or are we purely seeing a domestic affair over here?
I think that the Chinese will be watching this with growing nervousness. China and Pakistan have historically been close, but China has another reason for keeping Pakistan close, which is the fact that China, of course, is facing its own neo-Islamist insurgency in Xinjiang, which it's been trying to suppress now for many years with a signal lack of success. And one of China's nightmares is a join-up between the Taliban and its own insurrection. And of course, if there's a threat to the central power in Pakistan, then you can see the geography. You know, the forces blocking the Taliban from moving west along N35 up into eastern China may not be able to enforce that block any further. And the Taliban and the Uyghurs could actually form some kind of alliance.
Do you think China can do anything in this situation if it's so worried, or is it basically all it can do just to be on the side and watch what's happening?
I don't think that China can do anything, and China historically has been very reluctant to intervene in other countries' affairs, even where it is in a position to do something. So I think that all we can expect from Beijing for the time being is a certain amount of lamentation and hand-wringing.
Now we've been talking about Chinese reaction, Chinese thoughts. Samira, what do you think? Is India worried?
Well, I think India's always worried about Pakistan, to be honest. And I think that the one sort of predictable thing about Pakistan's politics is unpredictability. So I don't think it's anything that new, really, for its very close regional neighbours. I think the relations with India are deteriorating anyway over a sort of Pakistani minister's decision to meet with a Kashmiri separatist ahead of meetings with India. So India sort of pulled back. I think that, you know, that sort of indicates that there isn't going to be the softening of relations from India's side that was sort of some were predicting might happen when Modi took over. So I think that relationship is never going to be brilliant, in all honesty. And I think one of the biggest worries really for the government in Pakistan at the moment is that they were sort of elected with a mandate to really sort out the economy. It's a real basket case economy. It's really struggling. And that one of the things Nawaz Sharif promised to do was to sort of attract international investment and so on. And I think that is really jeopardised when you have not just wide-scale protests, but main opposition leaders like Imran Khan calling for people to stop paying taxes, stop paying electricity bills. I think that really sort of undermines any sense that it might be a good place to invest.
Let's finish today's discussion with a look at the latest developments in Gaza. Hostilities between Israel and Hamas flared up again last night, and peace talks in Cairo collapsed after a 10-day period of calm. 19 Palestinians have reportedly been killed in the last 24 hours. This spiraling violence has again raised the question, does Israel want perpetual war, and what could bring the peace talks in Cairo back to life? John, if I ask my first question from you, does Israel have an interest in perpetual war?
No, I don't think it does. I think this is one of these ideas that that stalks the political landscape at moments of high tension like this. But I think it's simply wrong. I think Israel has clear objectives, which they've stated. They want to destroy the tunnels between Gaza and anywhere, all the tunnels coming out of Gaza. And they want to force Hamas to stop firing missiles into Israel. Those are difficult objectives, but they are at least, you know, defined. I don't think Israel, if it ever achieved those objectives, would seek to prolong the conflict beyond them.
Today, at least two people have been killed in an airstrike on the home of the top military commander of Hamas. The fate of this commander, Mohammed Deif, remains unclear, though. Deif has topped Israel's most wanted list since at least 1996. What do you think in this kind of a situation? Would this kind of commander's death change the situation in any way?
Yes, I think it would. I mean, it could be clear, we don't know whether Deif is alive or dead.
Exactly.
But, you know, whether he was actually in the house at the time. We also need to bear in mind that wherever your political sympathies lie, I mean, Deif does have a lot of blood on his hands. I mean, the man was a bomb maker, orchestrated a lot of the operations that Hamas have engaged in. I think that if he were killed, that would certainly be a very major psychological blow to Hamas. Without knowing how deeply embedded he is at the moment in the command structure, it's impossible to say how far his removal would disrupt continuing Hamas operations. But I suspect that it would do to a considerable degree.
Well, the situation once again is the old familiar one. Israel is blaming Hamas and Hamas is blaming Israel. Zamira, what do you think? Who is to blame now for the resumption of hostilities?
I think it's so difficult to say in a conflict that's gone on for so long. I think, but certainly both sides have committed wrongdoing in this latest round of violence, as in the past. But I do think that it's so important not to forget the gross disproportionality. And I mean, when you look at just the sheer figures of it, that, yes, fine. I mean, both sides have done wrong and have carried out violence against civilians. But, you know, more than 2,000 Palestinians dead, nearly all of them civilians. And I think it's 64 Israeli soldiers dead and two civilians. And there's just really no comparison. So while I think both sides certainly have responsibility and I think both sides should face investigation for war crimes has been floated, I think there really can be no comparison on that question of proportion.
John, finally, let's turn our focus to the peace talks in Cairo. Do you think anyone is still left in Cairo and can much be done in Cairo in this situation?
I think that the peace talks, I think we have to accept that there will be an interruption, which will I hope, come to an end fairly soon. I personally am quite optimistic that the talks will resume once tempers calm down a bit and once both sides stop firing. In the end, I think it's become quite clear that Israel can't blast its way to its objectives and that Hamas really does need an Israeli ceasefire. So both sides are strongly motivated to work out some kind of deal. Whether they'll actually be able to do so, how long it will take, who knows?
We shall leave it there. John Everard and Samira Shackle, thank you very much again for joining us here at Midori House.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London, 这是 Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
20:30 in Helsinki, 18:30 here in London, 13:30 in New York City. On the second half of today's program, we will meet the man behind a new book about James Bond's creator, Ian Fleming. We will also review the best in comedy at this year's Fringe Festival in Scotland. But before all that, here is Susanne Gislett with the world news headlines.
Thank you, Marcus. The US President Barack Obama has said the beheading of American journalist James Foley is an act of violence that shocks the conscience of the entire world. Mr. Obama called the ideology of the Islamic State group, which released a video of Mr. Foley's killing, bankrupt and said it would ultimately fail. IS says the death of the journalist was in revenge for American airstrikes against them in northern Iraq. Rocket attacks and airstrikes are continuing in Gaza and southern Israel after the breakdown of the latest ceasefire. Israel accused Hamas of firing first, a claim the Palestinian militant group has denied. 47 people were arrested by police in the St. Louis suburb of Ferguson last night in the ongoing protests about the death of an unarmed black teenager. The US Attorney General Eric Holder is expected to visit today to be briefed on the investigations into the police shooting of Michael Brown. And more than 1,200 people have now died in the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. Security forces have been deployed in the Liberian capital Monrovia to try to enforce a quarantine area. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much. That was Susanne Gislett. And welcome back to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24. It is time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. And today we head to Istanbul. We'll get the biggest local discussion topics from our man there. Joseph Dana is joining me now. Welcome to the program, Joseph. Shall we start with recent news on what the Germans have been up to? German officials for quite a while already have been eager to criticize the US for the NSA's mass spying on Europeans and even Chancellor Angela Merkel. Well, now there's been embarrassing revelations that Germany has inadvertently spied on Hillary Clinton and John Kerry and has also deliberately targeted Turkey. If we concentrate on Turkey now, what has the reaction to this news been there?
Well, the reaction has been very, very angry. It's been flooding the local press here in Turkey. And effectively, we've seen two kind of reactions. We have to keep in mind that Turkey and Germany are very, very close allies. Germany is Turkey's largest trading partner, and it's also the home of the largest Turkish diaspora in Europe. And so these are two countries that know each other well and have a deep friendship. And so when this came out, President-elect Recep Tayyip Erdogan really used this opportunity, these revelations, to kind of jump and attack many members of the German press, specifically Der Spiegel, the magazine that actually released this information. Now, Der Spiegel has been running a number of very unsavory, sharply critical articles about Erdogan's rule in the build-up to the presidential election that happened on the 10th of August. And so Erdogan used this opportunity to really just cash in on some easy kind of political point, saying, you know, look, I told you that the German media was against us, and here we have evidence that they're even spying on us and whatnot. And it also comes on the backdrop of this ongoing wiretapping scandal that has really been gripping Turkey, in which followers of an Islamic preacher in the United States named Fethullah Gulen has been accused of trying to topple the current Turkish government through releasing a number of very, very serious wiretapes, including civil servants, people close to Erdogan, on major politicians. And so the fact that this is a wiretaping kind of scandal really does play into the government, the current government's line that there are very kind of nefarious and dangerous forces out there that are trying to sink the current government, and therefore the current government needs more political power and political will from the people. And so that's really how it's been playing out in the press here.
Well, now the dust is settling on the presidential election and gradually people are focusing on who is going to be the next prime minister then. There is a lot of speculation that the current foreign minister could take this seat, but anyhow, this seems to be something that cannot be taken for granted.
Yeah, absolutely. We've seen a number of murmurings just in the last 2 days coming from senior AK party officials. This is the party of Erdogan that will pick his replacement, who will be the kind of caretaker or custodian of the current government until the next round of elections. And we've seen these high-level sources come out and say that the foreign minister is actually going to take over the spot of prime minister. And we've even seen murmurings that the current intelligence chief of the national intelligence in Turkey, Hakan Fidan, will take over as foreign minister. And so what this really demonstrates is that those in power that have really sculpted Turkey's foreign policy over the last, let's say, 10 years are going to stay in power. And this is going to raise a very serious question and debate in this country as to where this country is exactly going. Now, the foreign minister, the current foreign minister, who will likely become the prime minister, Ahmet Davutoğlu, has really, you know, tried to sculpt this strategy of having zero problems with Turkey's neighbors. And this is really gone by the wayside. In fact, most people here say it's nothing but problems with the neighbors because, you know, the Turkish state has supported the Muslim Brotherhood quite vociferously. It's really kind of chosen the wrong horse in the Arab Spring, as it were, leaving Turkey very, very isolated. Now, the question is going to be if this prime minister, if Davutoğlu, who will presumably become prime minister, if he's going to be able to change this course and kind of heal Turkey's foreign reputation. And that's very much open at this point. You know, we've seen the ISIS situation in Iraq and Syria is showing no signs of letting up, and ISIS continues to take over very strategic points all over that territory that are coming close to the Turkish border. And so Turkey is still very much in a dangerous neighborhood that's going to require a very steady hand on the till, as it were. And if you read the Turkish press, or at least one segment of the Turkish press, you will see that there are serious questions as to whether or not the Turkish government, the current Turkish government, is going to be able to change this course and really you know, steer Turkey into a clear path of more relative stability in this very, very chaotic and unstable region.
Well, lastly, Joseph, you would like to take a look into the situation when it comes to Turkey and the Kurds.
Absolutely. This is just another example of how complex Turkey is, you know, in this very, very, very difficult region. So basically, we have the PKK, the Revolutionary Kurdish Fighters, who Turkey lists as a terrorist organization, that are basically being funded and, you know, kind of lightly armed by the Western community in their continuing fight against ISIS militants in Iraq specifically. And so we see a warming of relations between the PKK and the Turkish state, and there's a lot of discussion of whether or not we're going to see a peace agreement sometime soon. And this is coming on the heels of continued energy cooperation between Turkey and the Kurdistan regional government. We've seen news this week that something like 6.5 million barrels of oil have been exported to Turkey from the KRG and have been, you know, leaving Turkish ports on the Mediterranean and going out into the open sea. I'm seeing just this evening there's reports that one of these tankers holding Kurdish oil is actually going into Israel as we speak. And so we have a very, very odd constellation, which Turkey is making this kind of lukewarm move towards peace with both the Kurdistan regional government and the PKK, while there's still very strong tensions inside Turkey itself. And this is really the last point that I'll make, that there's been ongoing protests in the Turkish city of Diyarbakir, which is a known kind of Kurdish stronghold in Turkish territory. territory. And basically some people there, some Kurds, erected a monument to one of the founders of the PKK. And this monument has created a huge discussion in Turkey as to whether or not it can stand. And the Turkish government has actually decided to remove the monument, leading to real wide-scale protests in this area of Turkey. And so we see a very, very odd and complex picture that at once is moving towards some sort of historical resolution of this ongoing battle between the Kurds and Turkey, but still shows seeds of continued chaos. And so, you know, with the situation in Iraq as unstable as it is, we can continue to expect to see some of these very odd maneuverings by the Turkish state and the Kurds in the coming weeks and months, really.
Joseph Dana in Istanbul, thank you very much for this. Good talking to you. Up next, we'll head to Golden Eye, the house in Jamaica where Ian Fleming created James Bond. Stay tuned.
The entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages, and the successes of the business world. Every week, we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious, and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
It is a beautiful brand that it's all about giving the consumer the best possible product. We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
We put a shingle on the door, so to speak, which said brand strategy company 25 years ago, and people thought we were just mad poets and really didn't get what we were about.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, and the beer brewers of Ghana, the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
You get obsessed about the details, and if you're making the same product day in, day out, you build this incredible product that is very difficult to replicate.
So if you have an idea and want to drop that 9 to 5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
Global affairs, culture, business, design or urbanism. At Monocle 24, we've got it covered. And when it comes to transport and travel, you need look no further. From automobile innovators to the creative minds shaping the in-flight experience, we speak to the experts to ensure you have all the industry news you'll ever need. In New York, our transport editor, Tristan McAllister.
Whether it's a closer look at the global aviation heavyweights or embedding with the people who keep Alaska State Ferry System afloat, we take you to the people and the places that make our world move.
Take to the skies, the rails, the seas or the roads with Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Markus Hippi. James Bond may have become a national British icon, but his character was actually conceived in Jamaica, where author Ian Fleming lived from 1946 until the end of his life for a few months each year. Fleming loved Jamaica, a place where the glory of the empire was seemingly still preserved. Goldeneye, the house he built on the island's north coast, is where he wrote all the Bond novels. Goldeneye is also the name of a new book by Matthew Parker, which looks at that part of Fleming's life and work. And Matthew is here in the studio with us now. Welcome to the programme.
Hello, thanks, Marcus.
So I think the main question I want to ask from you is how much you approve with Fleming's taste. Would you want to spend a few months in that part of Jamaica as well?
Well, if you go to Goldeneye, which I've been lucky enough to do, it is a really beautiful spot. This small house with a lovely garden, a sunken garden with hibiscus and the hummingbirds and the butterflies. And then you climb down a few rocky steps and you get to this beach described by Fleming as about the size of a cricket pitch. And there is a small bay and out beyond is the reef, with the most extraordinary fish and excitement to be had, as Fleming discovered.
And who are the people living in Goldeneye now?
It's now a hotel owned by Chris Blackwell, who founded Island Records, and whose mother, Blanche Blackwell, has been a really key person for this book. She's 101 and in very good health and spirits. And she was described by Fleming's wife as Ian's Jamaican wife. And from 1957 until 1964, she was one of the reasons why Fleming loved Jamaica so much. She's a white Jamaican and full of spirit and full of mischief and full of the spirit of Jamaica. And Fleming really couldn't get enough of that.
Matthew, what kind of research did it take to write a book about Ian Fleming's Jamaica?
I think first and foremost, it was looking afresh at the books. A lot of people are familiar with them, and a lot has been written about Fleming. But I wanted to really take a fresh take, because you described in your intro as Fleming as a national icon. And it was really the moment where at the Olympic Games, the London Olympic Games in 2012, where Ian Fleming's creation, James Bond, and the Queen, these two great British anachronisms, stole the show in the 2012 opening ceremony. And everyone celebrated and laughed, and it was funny, and it was self-deprecating in a very English way. But then there was this head-scratching moment. How on earth had Ian Fleming's James Bond become such a depiction of Englishness or Britishness? And then you look at it, and I'd been out in Jamaica. I'd been researching a previous book that I'm a historian of the Caribbean. That's my speciality. And I discovered Goldeneye and the fact that all of the James Bond books and stories were written not in England, but in Jamaica. I found that fascinating. And not just where they were written, but when they were written, in the 1950s, which seems like now such a distant decade, where everything, certainly in Jamaica, everything went. There was this wonderful North Coast, Happy Valley style, hedonistic lifestyle. Meanwhile, the black Jamaicans are going from imperial backwater all the way through to independence. And all this is happening, and all this is reflected in the James Bond novels.
Can you give me examples of that influence in the books?
Well, if you look at there's a lot of Jamaica in the books. There's seven of them mentioned pirates, for instance, which was Ian Fleming's rather romanticised version of what is actually a pretty gruesome history in Jamaica. Three of them were set there, and several of the short stories were set there. And as I said, the reef is really Fleming's best moments as a writer, is when Bond is underwater. But if you look at Live and Let Die, the first one, his second novel, written in 1953, it's very much a touristic, old-fashioned Jamaica where nothing has changed for 100 years. People walk barefoot along the street, which for tourists, that's fantastic. For Jamaican nationalists, this is urgent social problems that need sort of addressing. And then you move forward to 1957, which is when Dr. No was written, which was, of course, the first James Bond film with Sean Connery, filmed in Jamaica in 1962, just before independence. And there you see a few cracks appearing in the imperial fantasy. You get suggestions that the bastion of colonial rule, Queen's Club, where the book starts, will one day be burnt to the ground and the windows smashed. All of the imperial rulers, the British, are pretty flaky. They've been infiltrated by Dr. No's spies. It's a very unsettling vision, very, very different to that earlier novel in Live and Let Die.
How much can you tell us about what kind of life Ian Fleming actually lived when he was residing in Goldeneye? How much work do you get done over there, first of all?
Well, there's no one single answer. It changes over the period of time. He went out there in 1946. He built this house, and it was a kind of bachelor pad. You know, Rosamund Lehman, the novelist, who's reputedly the most beautiful woman in Britain, came to stay. Lots of other people came to stay and had a very nice time, as long as they were happy going on the reef. If they weren't, they got chucked out and dumped on Noel Coward, who was the near neighbour and close friend of Ian Fleming's, bizarrely, in Jamaica. So that went on for a few years. But then in 1952, he got married when his lover, Anne Rothermere, who was married to the owner of the Daily Mail, became pregnant with his child. And they married. And at the same time, he produced the first Bond novel. And he always said, much to Anne's fury, that he wrote in order to get over the terrible spectre of matrimony, which obviously is rather offensive to Anne. But the fact is that writing those Bond novels at Goldeneye provided him with the private bachelor space that he had lost when the wife and child came along.
That was Matthew Parker, and his book is Goldeneye, Where Bond Was Born, Ian Fleming's Jamaica, and that book is out now. Thank you very much. 21:48 in Moscow, 18:48 in London. Now, whether it's on that long flight or perhaps tiresome ferry journey, or better if it's poolside or balcony seated, August is the perfect time to catch up on reading. Brand new fiction, hard-hitting biographies, or perhaps a classic that has stayed dusty on the shelf since school, it is still high reading time as many in the Northern Hemisphere try to relax a little. We have asked some of our regular Midori House friends, people whose taste we trust, totally of course, we've asked them to offer up their reading suggestions for the summer. And first off, we hear from Nina Schick from Open Europe, and then from Chris Frey, our Toronto correspondent.
Hi, I'm Nina Schick, and for this summer, I recommend that you read Shantaram. It's an epic 900-something paged book, and it's written by Gregory David Roberts, an Australian author. It's a semi-autobiographical piece, and it's an amazing story based on his own exploits in late 1970s. He was locked up in a jail in Australia for petty crime, the most notorious jail in Australia. And in 1980, he managed to escape, and upon escaping, he made his way to India. He spent 10 years in India, where he started a new life in the slums of Bombay, and became a local celebrity in the Bombay slums, and set up his own medical clinic, ended up working as an extra in Bollywood films, and then got involved in the murky underworld of the Bombay mafia. Now, he also ends up locked up back in jail in India, and then manages to get out and somehow ends up on further adventures in Afghanistan, where he ends up fighting with the Mujahideen. So it's a brilliant, brilliant story. It's long, but it is so interesting. It's so exciting. And it's something that you either love or you hate. And if you love it, as I did, then you simply won't be able to put it down.
Though it's a year old already, the book I'm recommending to everyone these days is Rachel Kushner's The Flamethrowers. It's a novel that really lives up to its rather combustible title. Set around the mid-1970s, it follows a young woman artist from Nevada interested in speed, motorcycles, and land art. She immerses herself in the New York conceptual art scene, and then as things shift over to Italy, she gets caught up in the radical leftist politics of the day, the chaos fomented by the Red Brigades and street protests and inevitable police crackdowns. I should note it's a book that's polarized both critics and my friends. Whether you buy into its tone and the world it creates might be a matter of personal sensibility, but for my money, few people today simply can write a more vivid or original sentence. It's not just the scintillating set pieces she creates within the narrative or her illusionist talent for blending fiction with history, but simply her knack for description. Without being at all precious or obscure, Kushner writes like a conceptual artist in only a sentence or a phrase upending our traditional way of looking at something. When I finished The Flamethrowers, I felt like my senses had been rearranged, and for the better. These past few months, I've also been on a bit of an obsessive kick, consuming as much of the work of French writer Emmanuel Carrère as I can. Three in particular: My Life as a Russian Novel, The Adversary, and Lives Other Than My Own. I don't know that any of his books figure as your typical summer reads. They may be too dark, existential, and full of self-loathing. And those three I just mentioned might be best described as novelistic documentaries and not fit any of the usual genres. The Adversary is about a seemingly respectable French doctor who murders his family and is revealed to have lived an intricately woven fraud for the past 20 years. I would make the case that The Adversary belongs alongside In Cold Blood as a classic of true crime reportage. Lives Other Than My Own, it takes the notoriously self-obsessed Carrère outside himself somewhat as he tells first the story of a young family that lost a daughter in the tsunami that struck Sri Lanka in 2004. Carrère and his family were actually vacationing there at the time. And then the story moves on to his sister-in-law as she dies from cancer while only in her mid-30s. That description hardly does justice to the surprising places where Carrère takes things. Suffice it to say, it's a book that will rip your heart out and then hand it back to you, somehow fuller with compassion and insight.
That was the book recommendation of Monocle's Toronto correspondent Chris Frey, and before him we heard from Nina Schick. You are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It is time now to review the best in the worlds of television, cinema, theatre, books and more, and today we concentrate on comedy. The Edinburgh Festival Fringe is a month-long bonanza that brings the best in theatre and comedy to Scotland. Bruce Dessau, art critic for the London Evening Standard, among others, has picked this year's Comedy Pearl for us and joins us now indeed from Edinburgh. Welcome to the programme, Bruce. What has been the best thing you've seen this far then?
Well, it's been a great month. I've been here, yes, non-stop for so long. I think I've seen about 100 shows in 3 weeks. And if I had to pick one out of all of those, it's a show by a British comedian called Alex Horn, who was one of the acts nominated for the Edinburgh Comedy Award today. What's been interesting about Edinburgh this year is how different the shows are. The seven nominees for the award, the winner is announced on Saturday and they win £10,000. They're all very different. Alex Horn actually, at one point in the show, he says, "Is this comedy?" Because he builds, I don't want to spoil the surprise because hopefully you'll all see the show one day. He builds something huge on stage, a giant version of a toy that a lot of people will have grown up with. So he spends the hour building something while also telling jokes. It's a marvellous feat of multitasking.
And looking at these other acts awarded that have been nominated for Foster's Award, what can you tell about the other ones? You mentioned Alex Horn's one. Now, looking at the other ones, for example, what Liam Williams has been coming up with.
Well, they're so different. I mean, Liam Williams, he's a sort of breakthrough act. He was nominated as a Best Newcomer last year, and now he's nominated as on the main prize list. His show is called Capitalism, and it's basically a sort of critique of the global corporate world, and he's very young. He doesn't like the corporate world, and he finds the humour in unpicking it. But every show is so different. Sarah Pascoe, for instance, who is very strongly fancied to win the award, her show is about Charles Darwin. It finds the humour in Charles Darwin. What's amazing is, comedians, when you have a funny mind, an eye for a joke, you can find humour in absolutely everything. There's another, one of the other nominees is John Kearns. Part of his show is about how he used to be a guide at the Houses of Parliament, and he's found the humour in that.
Bruce, how much humour is there actually in watching about 100 shows in 3 weeks? Can you be bothered to laugh anymore?
I'm always laughing on the inside. I think that's what I'm laughing on the inside. I'm laughing more now than at some of the shows I've seen, I think. You see some bad shows as well. It's not fair to name the bad ones, but they're not all five-star shows. And you have to see a lot. I mean, there are 647 shows here, comedy shows, just comedy, without counting theatre. So having seen about 100, I'm sort of barely scraping the surface, but hopefully I've found some of the good ones. You always get, what with social media and Facebook and Twitter, you get a sense of the shows that people are liking and you can sort of pick out the good ones. And that helps me keep my sense of humour.
Bruce, obviously you've been there before and comparing this year to previous years, is there anything absolutely new? Has anyone come up with anything that just hasn't been seen before?
Well, I think the nearest thing would be John Kearns. It's interesting that he's nominated as one of the main nominees this year because he was awarded Best Newcomer last year, and he's very strange. He's sort of, you have this thing called character comedy where people, like the pub landlords, they'll pretend to be a pub landlord, or there's a comedian who pretends to be a Frenchman. John Kearns wears false teeth and strange costumes and just sort of goes off on his own flights of surreal fancy. And that's very striking. It's sort of existentialism as comedy, I suppose.
How do you think the public has received that?
It's gone down very well. It's interesting because also what's interesting, he's doing a free show. So because you don't have to buy a ticket, you can just walk in. He does get a very mixed audience of sort of comedy intellectuals and comedy obsessives and just people who have been doing their shopping on a Saturday afternoon and wandered in because it's just in a room above a pub. And I think, he's very good. He wins most of the audience over, but you do see a few bemused faces in the crowd, which, again, he's very good at dealing with.
That was Bruce Dessau speaking to us from Edinburgh. Thank you very much for that, Bruce. And that's all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Samira Shackle and John Everard. Today's show was produced by Isabel Keza, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and David Pleasant, and our studio manager was Bill Luti. Next, after the headlines, is the Entrepreneurs Monocle's business programme with Daniel Ciacopelli. Later on, at 2200 hours London time, it is the Monocle Daily with Andrew Müller and myself. And this show will be back at the same time tomorrow at 1800 hours London time. But for this edition of Midori House, it is goodbye. Thank you for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.